From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. They are called counts. They are actually formal accusations provided for by the Constitution and carrying the weight of history. America's 45th president, Donald John Trump, was impeached on two counts. Speaker Nancy Pelosi wielded the gavel on the House floor Wednesday night.
On this vote, the yeas are 229, the nays are 198, present is one, Article 2 is adopted.
It was the most votes to impeach an American president ever. It was also a vote divided sharply along party lines, and the path to a Senate trial to see whether the president will be convicted and removed remains unclear, though the Republican majority has his back. Trump appeared unfazed in the Oval Office yesterday.
I don't feel like I'm being impeached because it's a hoax. It's a setup. It's a horrible thing they did.
Trump will carry this label for the ages, and yet it's not clear how it will affect him in his bid for re-election just next year. The president's allies in Washington say it will energize his supporters. Across the country in Los Angeles, Democrats agreed on the need to beat Trump and then seized the moment to attack one another.
He's received contributions from 44 billionaires. Pete, on the other hand, is trailing, Pete. You only got 39.
I did not come here to listen to this argument.
Senator Warren, you would be the oldest president ever inaugurated. I'd like you to weigh in as well.
I'd also be the youngest woman ever inaugurated.
Join us. What do you make of this historic moment? How do you want the Senate to proceed? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on the Twitters and the Facebook at On Point Radio. With us from Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, Juana Summers. She's political reporter for NPR. Juana, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Washington, D.C., Katie Rogers. She's White House correspondent for the New York Times. Katie, great to have you on board.
Hi there. Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty, joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Juana, and Katie.
Well, you saw this week something that we haven't seen a ton of in recent months. Protests sprouted to advocate impeachment in more than 600 sites across the country Tuesday night. Here's what it sounded like at a sampling of demonstrations from Seattle, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Denver, and the Twin Cities.
When Trump publicly asked Russia to interfere in our elections, it was time to impeach.
This is our country, for us, by us, and if we don't speak out, then shame on us.
Well, those particular protesters got their wishes at her weekly press briefing on Thursday in the Capitol. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi addressed reporters with what she called a spring in her step after the impeachment vote wrapped up. She outlined what she said would be next in the process.
Just to get this off the table right away, we impeached the president immediately. Everybody was on to the next thing. The next thing for us will be when we see the process that is set forth in the Senate, then we'll know the number of managers that we may have to go forward and who we would choose.
So let's start with you. Juana Summers, you covered Congress. You're now covering politics, but you've covered Congress before. Before we step forward and look at what's ahead in terms of the connective tissue getting us from the House to the Senate, how big a moment is this for Nancy Pelosi? How important a step was this by House Democrats as we look at it?
Well, this entire thing has been a huge moment for Nancy Pelosi. If you think back to the beginning of her speakership, this is someone who a number of lawmakers said during their campaigns they weren't going to support a speaker. And now she is in this position, which she started out saying, you know, she was not interested in going down this road. She was interested in following the facts where they might lead. And ultimately, the facts led her here at this historic vote. So it's a huge moment for her and a historic moment for the Congress. Donald Trump, the president, becoming the third president only to be impeached. So it's certainly a huge moment on Capitol Hill and one with little historic precedent as to what comes next. And of course, I can't help but mention politics. This all takes place in an election year, which raises the stakes even higher.
And we'll certainly be talking about that as this hour unfolds. Katie Rogers, you cover the White House. I want to play for you a clip of the occupant of the White House. President Trump held a campaign rally in Battle Creek, Michigan, Wednesday night. His two-hour remarks included one riff after another, included scattershot attacks on many of his critics and political foes and riffs on all kinds of other subjects, as well as an attack on the very impeachment vote that was playing out in the nation's capital even as he spoke.
With today's illegal, unconstitutional, and partisan impeachment, the do-nothing Democrats, and they are do-nothing, all they want to do is focus on this, what they could be doing, are declaring their deep hatred and disdain for the American voter. This lawless partisan impeachment is a political suicide march for the Democrat Party.
Katie Rogers, this is – there's a lot to unpack in those few sentences there from the president. To start with, not unconstitutional, you know, whatever – you can certainly call it partisan, the impeachment process with perhaps some grounding, but not illegal and not unconstitutional. What is the president doing there?
Well, I thought it was really interesting when you opened by saying he appeared unfazed in the Oval, because that is the sound of the opposite of unfazed, I would think, for the president. That's probably one of the worst days of his political career, if not his life. And he has been responding privately and publicly in kind. So that is that a lot of those words that he used the other night were actually contained in that long letter he wrote to Speaker Pelosi the other day. He's basically been searching for a pressure release valve to just call this unconstitutional and illegal and unfair, when in fact the White House has actually stonewalled Congress at every turn throughout this process. So I think what we're seeing is just a president who is embarrassed and frustrated to be the third to be impeached in American history. And I would definitely not call him unfazed.
It seemed as though in that meeting he was – your colleagues actually reported today that he was laboring under the belief, or at least that some of his aides were trying to convince him, that Nancy Pelosi just didn't have the votes despite what their congressional liaison was trying to warn them of.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there are advisors close to the president who will tell him what he wants to hear. And I think there are other advisors who toil away to try to gently correct that. You know, I do a lot of reporting on the White House. It's my job. And I think that they like to present an image of unity and say this has been a really galvanizing moment for everybody. But you really still have, and maybe even more so right now, you have an increased number of loyalists to the president who are willing to sort of tell him things like that.
At that rally in Battle Creek Wednesday, the president referred to what he said was a kindness he extended after the death of Michigan Democratic Congressman John Dingell, who had served in Congress for decades. And then he implied Dingell had gone to hell. Trump spoke about the call he'd received from Representative Debbie Dingell, who's John Dingell's widow and his successor as member of Congress, after Dingell's funeral.
She calls me up. It's the nicest thing that's ever happened. Thank you so much. John would be so thrilled. He's looking down. He'd be so thrilled. Thank you so much, sir. I said, that's okay. Don't worry about it. Maybe he's looking up. I don't know.
Jack Beatty, how'd that play in Michigan? How'd that play in Congress?
Well, even Republicans winced over that crude and really appalling statement. You know, Stephanie Grisham, the White House press secretary, said, if that job still exists, said the president is a counterpuncher. Here he's counterpunching against the dead. It's just a comment unworthy of any human being, much less the president.
Jack, I also want to ask you, you and I talk before the show, as we often do, and you said in a sense, you know, this was a trap that the president stood poised to wriggle out of. And then you said something that was interesting. You said that he really, in a sense, self-impeached. What do you mean by that?
Well, that was a phrase that Nancy Pelosi used. She actually said he would self-impeach. Consider the record. In July, he was home free. 60% of Democrats in the House voted against impeachment on the Mueller report. Then, on I think the 24th of July, Mueller testified a big fizzle. What does the president is home free? He was charged with colluding with a foreign power to win an election. Nope. Free of that, he was charged with possibly obstruction of justice. That wasn't going to be raised against by the Democrats. Next day, what does he do? He talks to the president of a foreign power about interfering in the next election. And then that's Article 1, the abuse of power. And then Article 2, stonewalling of Congress, he creates that article by simply saying, I don't care what Nixon did. Nixon may have sent people over to testify. Nobody's going to testify, essentially inviting that article. Because if the Congress had accepted that, it would be congressional power would be gelded in perpetuity. And, you know, it doesn't just stop there. The Article 1 warns that he remains a threat to national security and the Constitution if allowed to remain in office. And how is his conduct now? Is it threatening anything like that? Well, you have Rudy Giuliani still, just a week ago, in Ukraine, prospecting for more dirt on Biden, and Jake Tapper put it perfectly. He said, this Rudy's mission to Ukraine would be tantamount to Bill Clinton, at the midst of the impeachment, his impeachment, going out for a night on the town with Monica Lewinsky.
You know, it's notable, Jack, that that the nation appears to be slightly in favor of impeachment, even slightly perhaps supporting the president's removal in some polls, and yet sharply split. And yet there was an editorial posted last night by Christianity Today, an evangelical publication, a centrist one, which writes, the facts in this instance are unambiguous. The president of the United States attempted to use his political power to coerce a foreign leader to harass and discredit one of the president's political opponents. That is not only a violation of the Constitution, more importantly, is profoundly immoral. And then writes later on that the president's Twitter feed alone is a near perfect example of a human being who's morally lost and confused. Interesting shakeout as impeachment actually occurs as to what happens. We're going to be talking not only about this, but about how it moves forward, what happens in the Senate, what the political implications are. We want you to join our conversation. Stick around. How is your community reacting to the impeachment of Donald John Trump, 45th president of the United States? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com. Code POD.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're taking a look this week as a historic moment and also as part of what's happening right now. It's just the third time an American president has been impeached. You can join our conversation. How will impeachment influence your thinking in the 2020 presidential election, if at all? Follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. We've got a crackerjack panel this hour. We're speaking with Juana Summers. She's a political reporter for NPR. Katie Rogers, White House correspondent for The New York Times, and our own Jack Beatty, On Point's news analyst. First, want to start, as promised, with a couple of calls. We've got a call from New Bedford, Massachusetts. Paul, thanks for listening. Thanks for calling in.
Few comments. Trump is a nasty piece of work from the mentorship of Roy Cohn. We have to keep drumming that home to everybody constantly. Be in front of the message like he does. So, and my question is, how do we strong arm the Senate? Have some teeth in having them get the guys who are guilty in this to testify. Giuliani, Mulvaney, Pompeo. These guys covered this up. They need to be exposed for who they are. And like, massively. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay, Paul, thanks for that. Let me throw that to someone who used to cover Congress quite intensely and still keeps a strong eye on it for us here at NPR. Want to tell us a little bit about that. Senate Minority Leader, that is this top Senate Democrat, Chuck Schumer, has said, look, we really need some witnesses here. What are we hearing from Mitch McConnell?
So far, we have not heard anything to suggest that Mitch McConnell will acquiesce to that. But I think that to the root of the caller's question, this is what Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, is holding out for. House lawmakers have left town for a 2-week holiday recess without taking the votes to appoint impeachment managers, which would be the next step to start this process in the Senate. Nancy Pelosi has said publicly that she will not send those charges over and she will not name the lawmakers who would prosecute the case against President Trump unless she's certain of a fair process. I think the hope there is that Senator McConnell, majority leader, will end up committing to Democratic demands, including the ability to call witnesses during a trial, because the president, you know, is very eager to present his defense and clear his name. So by holding on to these articles, I think that that's kind of the leverage she's hoping to use in order to get the witnesses the Democrats say they want to see in that Senate trial.
I just want to play for you and for listeners a clip of what that reasoning sounds like, I guess. House Majority Whip James Clyburn, South Carolina, he's the number 3 Democrat in the House, was interviewed on CNN's News New Day yesterday and was asked by anchor John Berman how he'd proceed with conveying the House impeachment counts to the Senate for trial.
Are you willing to hold the articles indefinitely if Mitch McConnell doesn't concede the points that you're asking him to? Are you suggesting it's possible you will never transmit the articles of impeachment?
If it were me, yes, that's what I'm saying. I have no idea what the speaker would do. But if you have a preordained outcome that's negative to your actions, why walk into it?
Noah Feldman's distinguished constitutional law professor at Harvard University was called by the Democrats in front of the House Judiciary Committee to sort of set out what was appropriate constitutionally for impeachment. He argues he thinks that if the House doesn't convey those counts to the Senate, that it's not actually – that impeachment has not formally somehow occurred. It's sort of a looking glass moment. It's hard to know exactly how to pinpoint it, but that is his argument under the Constitution. How much leverage do Democrats have, and what happens if they don't send it over? I mean, it would seem as though they would be not taking seriously what they had done.
Yeah, and I think that's really the political gamble here that Speaker Pelosi and Democrats face. Speaker Pelosi has said that impeachment is a solemn, somber act. It is something she does not take lightly and came very serious to. So if, say, she were to hang on to these charges for negotiating leverage or, as Congressman Clyburn suggested, perhaps never deliver them at all, she risks appearing to politicize the matter. And that's something that could have ramifications not just for her and her speakership and the impeachment trial, but for a lot of these moderate congressmen and women who are in districts that President Trump won, who are going to be up for re-election in November. So there is a lot on the line here. It's certainly a risky gamble.
I want to play you what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell sounds like during Thursday morning's Senate session. He simply attacked the House Democrats' vote on impeachment.
The articles aren't just unproven. They're also constitutionally incoherent. Incoherent. Frankly, if either of these articles is blessed by the Senate, we could easily see the impeachment of every future president of either party.
Katie Rogers, we've heard that line from a number of Republican lawmakers in the House arguing against impeachment, saying, well, if this happens, it's going to make it the new normal. Part of me says, you know, they're warning about, in some ways, what they are arguing is lowering the bar two decades after President Clinton was impeached. And part of it sounds a little bit like that old National Lampoon magazine, you know, buy this magazine or I'll shoot this dog. You know, it sounds like a not-so-implied threat.
A lot of it sounds like exactly what the president's been saying for months, which is like this should never happen to another president again. Like this has been hammered into Republican messaging and talking points from the top down, you know.
It's a little bit farther than saying simply, hey, you know, we're worried about degrading the office. It's saying, hey, this is going to happen to every future president of either party.
Yeah.
And obviously we're the people who hold the reins, so we're the people who can make sure that happens.
Well, and I think embedded in a talking point like that is fundamentally stoking fear and anxiety amongst your supporters that the government and the institutions that form this government are not to be trusted. And that's just being enforced by elected officials. And yeah, I wanted to go back to Juana's really good points about the gamble Nancy Pelosi is taking and McConnell's response. Really hurt the risk in what she is doing is treating Trump like the wild card he can be. He has talked about wanting a long trial, bringing everything out to prove his vindication. The precise gamble she's making is that he'll get impatient enough to actually agree to some Democratic demands. It's less about what Pelosi and McConnell are willing to do and more about how this president who's watching and wondering what she's doing, she's gambling that he's just going to get tired of it.
Is she gambling on his irrationality ultimately?
I mean, I think that's why it's so risky, because she knows that he wants a long trial. She knows that he wants a full-bodied vindication of everything, and she's betting that he's going to get impatient.
Jack, have we heard anything? You know, also in that Mitch McConnell quote, he said that the articles aren't just unproven, they're also constitutionally incoherent. Now, the first count is abuse of power, and that is a subjective thing. The second thing is obstruction of Congress. And it cited the president's basically not invoking executive privilege, but nonetheless blocking the testimony of a bunch of senior administration officials that the House had called. Have we seen a legal argument that makes the case that somehow this isn't obstruction of Congress that makes a certain kind of sense?
I mean, I've heard Republican bloviators on TV, you know, talking heads saying presidents can resist subpoenas from Congress. This happens all the time and so on. But usually that's with a claim of executive privilege. And if a person is subpoenaed, they go to Congress. And when a question arises that is privileged, the administration official invokes executive privilege. The president simply said, as one of his lawyers said, he just claimed absolute immunity. There is no such thing. Kings have that, not presidents. And it's such a dramatic remove from what even Richard Nixon did, we remember Haldeman and Ehrlichman testifying, John Dean testifying, his counsel, on and on. He turned over documents. He didn't, in the end, of course, turn over the tapes, but that's what got him, out of office, not doing that. And of course, Bill Clinton did the same thing. With this president, he simply says this is a political stunt. It's a partisan witch hunt. And of course, the media echoes this when they say impeachment is a political process. That doesn't mean, or the founders didn't think it meant partisan. Mm-hmm. Hamilton says, yeah, in a peculiar degree, the crimes that stand for impeachment should be denominated political, in that they are crimes against society. In other words, the political to which Hamilton refers is a bigger thing and a graver thing than mere crime, and certainly a bigger and graver thing than partisan politics.
And a question of judgment. I want to take a call now from Stanton, Virginia. David, thank you for standing by. Thank you for joining us. Share your thoughts on all this.
Yes, thank you all for your excellent program. My observation and question is this. This whole impeachment process has uncovered an incredible weakness in the process, whereby it is unbelievably partisan in every respect, especially now as we look at the supposed trial in the Senate. Is it time for, after all this is said and done, to have a commission or some kind of body to go back and review this whole process and come up with a constitutional amendment that would take the partisanship out of future impeachment processes like this, ensure a fair trial, ensure that no political party could unduly influence this. The Founding Fathers came up with a simple statement of impeachment, believing that future leaders would put country above party, and that has been disabused in this situation.
All right. Well, David, thank you for that. Let me throw that. Juana Summers, is there a way in which we can think about an impeachment and take a partisanship out of it. That is, Jack has made what I think is an elegant and important distinction. But, you know, politics and partisanship overlap, right? But they're not identical. Political judgments can be judgments that are subjective and that, you know, take measurement as opposed to, you know, strict legal definitions, right? Is there a way in which partisanship can be extracted from this at all? I'm not sure I see it. I used to cover Congress. What about you?
That's a great question. I used to cover Congress too, and I'm not sure how you do that, because I think it raises the question of fair to who and whom, right? I think that if you were to ask President Trump what a fair trial looks like and ask Speaker Pelosi what a fair trial looks like, the answer is never going to be the same. The tricky thing here, I think, is that there are so few precedents for what we are seeing unfold right now. We've said it multiple times. This is a historic moment. President Trump is only the third president to be impeached. So a lot of the process that we're seeing here is kind of uncharted territory. So I think the listener raises a really good question, but I'm not sure it's one that I have an answer for and that there's even a great template to look back to.
It's interesting, though, because when I covered the impeachment process in 99, I spent a lot of time in those corridors, right? And I was there in the Senate trial as well. And Tom Daschle was the Senate minority leader for the Democrats. Trent Lott was the Senate majority leader for the Republicans of Mississippi. Both of them were shrewd and tough partisans, right? They were tough and they were on their party. They were able to figure out an accommodation. Now, maybe it was because they knew that Clinton wasn't going to get the numbers to be removed from office, and maybe because the public wasn't along for the ride with the Republicans on this. But nonetheless, they figured out a way to do it. They had three witnesses. They did not testify in the well of the Senate. Monica Lewinsky, I believe, gave testimony by video, and it was played, and senators could, you know, watch the testimony. I mean, they figured out a process ultimately that both sides agreed with. It just seems very hard to see that happen in Mitch McConnell's Senate and in today's Washington.
It absolutely does. One of the things that struck me anecdotally from being on the campaign trail, as we've talked to folks about how they feel about impeachment and being in the halls of the Capitol, is just how many raw nerves there are about all of this on all parts of the political spectrum. It is difficult for me to imagine an agreement that would come together in such a way that you would see a trial like the one that you covered play out.
You're asking to change American culture. You're asking, I mean, American political culture, not really the impeachment process.
Katie, you're basically saying, look, dude, this is today's America. So America's shifted even more, become even more divided and partisan than it was. And this, you feel that Washington is a reflection of, not a cause of, the kinds of division we're seeing in to some regard. I don't want to speak for you, but I want to make sure I understand.
I mean, I think American politics have become tribalized more than before, and I can't help but think that governments around the world who would like to see the American democratic process undermined. I hate to think this, but I assume that this is the sort of outcome that governments like that would like.
Jack, I want to play a clip from you. In his closing statement on Wednesday during the debate over this, House Minority Leader, that is to say the leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives, Kevin McCarthy of California, accused Democrats of using impeachment to drive the 2020 presidential election their way.
I understand you dislike the president, his beliefs, the way he governs, and even the people who voted for him. How do I know this? Because you say so day in and day out. In 2016, they even dismissed his supporters. Remember calling us deplorables? Now they are trying to disqualify our voice before the 2020 election.
Chuck Beatty, it strikes me that this is part of the message of the moment. That is, if you vote against Trump, you are voting against us, in quotes, that is, those who support him, those who believe in Republican positions and values. How valid, how justified is this sense of aggrievement about what's being done here?
Well, statistics say it's justified on the economic count. Consider this. Over the last decade, GDP growth in Democratic districts has been 63%. Republican districts 36%. Over the last decade, median household income has jumped 17% in Democratic districts, fallen 3% in Republican districts. At the share of jobs in digital and the professions in Democratic districts, 71%. The share of these future-facing jobs in Republican districts, 28%. You can see the difference, really, in Jim Jordan, the short-sleeved Furioso from Urbana, Ohio. He talks about, you know, the Democrats. He quoted one of the FBI agents who had their romance on email, saying he'd gone into a Walmart and smelled them, meaning Trump voters. I mean, this is raw stuff. His district, the fourth district of Ohio, median income 55%. Adam Schiff's district in California 28, 65%. Jerry Nadler's district, New York 10, $93,000.
So what does this tell you, Jack?
Income. It tells me that the Republicans are the party of, in a certain stretch, the have-nots, the left-behinds, the aggrieved. It's clear they're aggrieved culturally, probably racially, also economically.
We're discussing the week's top news stories. Coming up, we'll switch gears to talk a bit about last night's Democratic presidential debate in Los Angeles and the question of what's ahead in 2020. Who made a compelling case on the debate stage? How have your allegiances shifted? We'd love your thoughts. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're going behind the headlines with our Week in the News roundtable. You can join our conversation. What stood out to you from last night's presidential debate? Follow us on the Twitters. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with Juana Summers. She's political reporter for NPR. Katie Rogers, White House correspondent for The New York Times. And Jack Beattie, On Point's own news analyst. Want to take a couple of quick calls here to folks who are still thinking, I think, about the historic news this week of the impeachment of President Donald Trump. Edith, thank you for listening today. She's calling from Canton, Connecticut. What are your thoughts today, Edith?
Hi. I believe in party loyalty to a point. I think it has gone far beyond that point. The Senate majority Republicans have already made up their mind without hearing the proper testimony that should be heard for the people mainly to make up their minds when they go to the polls. For the few Republican delegates who had the nerve to speak up, out, and against what the president has said over the months, I believe they deserve a medal of some kind. So until the subject becomes nonpartisan and the laws that apply are used properly, I just don't see where this is going, other than the headlines that the president was impeached should stay in minds for a long time.
Well, thank you for that, Edith. I want to take also a quick call now from the Menominee Reservation in Wisconsin. Basil is calling in. Thank you for listening, Basil. Share your thoughts today.
Yeah, hi, and thanks for taking my call. You're talking to somebody here who's watched and listened from gavel to gavel from this whole process, from when it all starts, you know, to make up my own mind. And one of your callers, a couple callers ago, had said, how can we take the partisanship out of, you know, what has completely gone crazy partisan to the point where nobody's crossing sides? Well, you got a Democrat who crossed sides and now is a Republican. But how do we take that out there? Well, there's no law, but there is something that they're saying is a rule or something the DOJ just goes by, where they cannot bring charges against any sitting president. Mm-hmm. Now, if we got some untouchables, some bipartisan people, some good stand-up people, you know, to get into a committee and just have that committee be like an oversight committee, but not part of Congress, not political. And we had these people to be able to look over Congress, senators, whatever, whoever. And, you know, if there's a crime, if there's some smoke, well, they go see if there's some fire. If there's no fire, then they put it out. Then they report they put it out. But if there's fire, then they go after that fire. They charge the sitting president. And our president right now would be sitting right next to his man, his first attorney over there, who was doing time for lying to Congress.
All right, Basil, thank you for that suggestion, a call for a kind of commission or extra outside the executive committee's check, I guess, to the powers of the presidency there. We are following a couple other news stories this week. As the Wall Street Journal and others report, the British Parliament voted overwhelmingly to back Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. That's a major step to the departure of the UK from the EU by January 31st. And how could you miss this? Thursday night was the Miss America pageant. The winner was Miss Virginia, Camille Schrier. She's a doctoral student in pharmacy, and for her talent, she performed an on-stage science experiment. I gotta love that. Katie Rogers, I want to turn – sort of use this moment to both acknowledge impeachment, yes, but use that to turn towards next year. President Trump held this rally in Battle Creek, Michigan. Although he made no reference to this, it happens to be the congressional district of Justin Amash, a sort of libertarian-minded Republican who essentially felt himself forced out of the party as he increasingly became convinced that what the president had done might well prove to be impeachable, and he did vote for the articles of impeachment against the president. But this week also, New Jersey Representative Jeff Van Drew, a Democrat who won election in 2018, who declared he'd switch parties this week to Republican after deciding he would oppose both articles of impeachment against President Trump. He made the announcement of his party switch beside the president in the Oval Office yesterday.
I believe that this is just a better fit for me. This is who I am. It's who I always was, but there was more tolerance of moderate Democrats, of blue dog Democrats, of conservative Democrats, and I think that's going away. Two more things I want to say. One, you have my undying support.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And always.
And by the way, the same way.
Thank you.
I'm endorsing him.
Undying support, a presidential endorsement for Jeff Van Drew. How much is this going to be, as Republicans, the president, assert a liability for Democrats? And how much, conversely, one of the things you don't hear about, how much is it possible that Republicans, say, running for Senate reelection or other lawmakers may be held to account for their decision to oppose the impeachment of the president?
Well, I mean, I guess I can just – I can speak to the counter assault that the White House and the Republican Party is launching against Democratic candidates and lawmakers. And Van Drew is definitely a part of that larger operation to sort of paint the Democratic Party as radical, liberal, corrupt, and, unable to get the work of the American people done. I think that, the White House and specifically the two impeachment advisors hired to defend the president through this process, they say they're feeling bullish about the ability to bring more Republicans in line and on their side. But if you talk to Republican and Democratic pollsters, and I have right now, this is a lot of smoke and mirrors on both sides, I think. The numbers are relatively static polling-wise. Like, minds have not been changed through this process because Americans tend to feel it that it is totally polarized and not worth their time to engage with. I think going forward, as the Democratic nominee is identified and that discussion begins happening, then they'll begin moving. The numbers might begin moving substantially in either direction. The Senate trial, of course. But right now, it's a lot of messaging and not a lot of movement.
Last night's presidential debate took place at Loyola Marymount University on the west side of Los Angeles. In it, you didn't hear a whole lot of candidates talking much about impeachment last night. And in fact, former Vice President Joe Biden made the case for bipartisanship during the debate.
I refuse to accept the notion, as some on this stage do, that we can never, never get to a place where we have cooperation again. If that's the case, we're dead as a country. We need to be able to reach consensus. And if anyone has reason to be angry with the Republicans and not want to cooperate, it's me. The way they've attacked me and my son and my family, I have no love. But the fact is, we have to be able to get things done.
Juana Summers, you heard there a call for bipartisanship, and yet Democrats started to take aim significantly with each other during the debate. Tensions between South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg and Senator Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts surfaced strongly during the debate. Warren took aim at Buttigieg for his fundraising tactics.
Billionaires in wine caves should not pick the next president of the United States.
Mr. Mayor, your response. You know, according to Forbes magazine, I am literally the only person on this stage who's not a millionaire or a billionaire. So if this is important, this is the problem with issuing purity tests you cannot yourself pass.
Juana, you cover politics in the 2020 race. What did we see play out last night?
Yeah, well, first of all, I want to clarify for our listeners who might not know why we're talking about wine caves on a debate stage,
sure,
that a lot of the candidates piled on South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg for being hosted for a fundraiser in a wine cave where $900 bottles of wine were served. It was hosted by a billionaire former ambassador. So that's kind of the root of what they're talking about there. But we really saw a break open as Buttigieg has risen in the polls. He has increasingly become the target of jabs from his rivals. He and Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren have been in this long-running debate over transparency and openness, with Warren putting a lot of pressure on him to open up his fundraisers, which he is now doing to a press pool, to disclose his bundlers, something that he has now done. He also took a lot of hits from Amy Klobuchar, the senator from Minnesota, who talked about his lack of experience comparatively and how in the past debate she felt, and I'm paraphrasing here, that he belittled the experience of the other candidates on the stage, him being a mayor standing beside these folks, a former vice president, several sitting senators and what have you.
So let me play a clip for our listeners so they can experience that as well. Senator Amy Klobuchar took aim at Buttigieg by pointing to those comments from the last debate. He criticized the fellow candidate's years of experience in Washington as something detrimental. Here's what Senator Klobuchar had to say.
So while you can dismiss committee hearings, I think this experience works. And I have not denigrated your experience as a local official. I have been one.
You know,
I just think you should respect our experience when you look at how you evaluate someone who can get things done.
Thank you, Senator.
And I got to say, Klobuchar used the word mayor against Buttigieg like a crowbar, you know, hitting him repeatedly with that word. After trading barbs back and forth, Buttigieg fired back.
Senator, I know that if you just go by vote totals, maybe what goes on in my city seems small to you. If you want to talk about the capacity to win, try putting together a coalition to bring you back to office with 80% of the vote as a gay dude in Mike Pence's Indiana.
How did the gay dude in Mike Pence's Indiana do with that comeback, Juana?
Well, you know, I think that they were hoping that it would land. And Klobuchar, of course, pointing out that Buttigieg lost a state treasurer's race in 2010 by more than 20 points, which is the only time he ran in a statewide election. I think that a lot of the Democrats on the stage have been pointing out his relative inexperience compared to, they would argue, their experience. But there's no question that he is someone who, over the last few months, has been rising in the polls in these early states. And they're trying to figure out kind of what to do with that, because he's also somebody who is a newer, fresh face in this party who's going to be around, if he does not become the Democratic nominee and later the president, for years to come.
Let's take a call now from Salem, Massachusetts. Jenna, thanks for listening. Who struck you last night as particularly impressive?
Hi. I just cannot get over the fact that Amy Klobuchar is not taking off. I feel like demographically, policy-wise, she just fits the country, and I feel like she's being overlooked. I feel like last night, especially her debate performance, she was the only one out there who looked like she could actually hit back. I'm an independent, and I voted for actually Gary Johnson last time and Mitt Romney before that. And I'm really only considering her or Pete Buttigieg. And last night, I thought she looked on fire, and I think she could actually win.
And if one of those two don't get nominated, what do you do?
That's what I'm trying to figure out. I actually have two young daughters, and I cannot bring myself to vote for Trump. I have a lot of friends in my same situation who lied and said they didn't vote for him last time, and I know that they did, and I can see that happening again this time because economically they're doing great, and they have to look to their families, and I feel like they will not vote for Elizabeth Warren. They will not vote for Bernie, and Joe Biden just looks weak. I just feel like he can't win.
Thanks for that thought, Jenna. Jack Beatty, a number of folks last night, including people not particularly aligned with him, said Joe Biden actually had a pretty good night last night and that Bernie Sanders seemed to hold his own as well. How did you see the performances play on stage?
I thought it was one of Joe Biden's better performances. The pundits on the MSNBC and CNN, they gave the debate to him and to Amy Klobuchar. The trouble for Senator Klobuchar is that her vote, she's competing for his votes. So he did well, she did well. It's not like she, in other words, he may have, their relative position, at least in terms of the debate, didn't change. And maybe that won't be, maybe it will or won't be reflected in the electorate. She's got to do well in Iowa to survive. And it's a brutal calculus now, because if you don't make that, if she doesn't make that, if Elizabeth Warren doesn't do well in New Hampshire, they're really done for.
You know, Katie Rogers, I was struck by that clip. We played the portion of it at the top of the hour from Elizabeth Warren when being asked about being the oldest president inaugurated, mm-hmm. should she win, saying she'd be the youngest woman to take office, too. And, it was a very strong
How
rhetorical
long do you think
moment.
She's been waiting to say that?
She may have been had that in her back pocket for some time.
She might have.
Katie, the Democratic National Committee are going to increase the qualification standards for its next debate next month. So they're going to have to receive at least 5% support in 4 qualifying polls or some more in 2 early polls, making it likely that we'll see fewer than the 7 we saw on stage. Last night's debate, presidential candidate Andrew Yang was asked about being the only candidate of color on stage. And he said his proposals will help diversify the playing field.
The average net worth of a black household is only 10% that of a white household. For Latinos, it's 12%. If you're a black woman, you're 320% more likely to die from complications in childbirth. These are the numbers that define race in our country. And the question is, why am I the lone candidate of color on this stage? Fewer than 5% of Americans donate to political campaigns. You know what you need to donate to political campaigns? Disposable income.
Katie Rogers, it strikes me the Democrats are trying to figure out a way to win a huge field. And at the same time, by playing by these early states, some of which are heavily white, they're essentially making it much harder for candidates of color to compete and break through. How tenable is this for Democrats?
I'm not – that's not really something I can speak to.
Okay. I mean, I actually wrote about this week about the debate that's broken open over whether Iowa and New Hampshire are too white to go first in the primary process. And I don't think it's tenable at all. And the reason you see that is you actually had, led by Cory Booker, all of the leading candidates signed a letter to the DNC asking that they not raise the thresholds like they just did, but actually to lower them so that this is a more diverse debate. I think so far either 4 or 5 of the candidates have already qualified for the next debate, including Amy Klobuchar. But yet again, Democrats are running the risk of having an all-white debate stage in January.
The final word given Juana Summers, political reporter for NPR. Thanks, Juana, so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
We've also been lucky enough to receive the insight of Katie Rogers. She's White House correspondent for the New York Times. Thank you, Katie.
Thank you.
And thanks to our On Point news analyst, Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on the Twitters and Facebook at On Point Radio. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik. Thanks for listening. This is On Point.